I haven't heard that one.
There you go.
That's super lame.
You're welcome.
I'm curious to ask about the homeschooling thing. The reason being is, I mean, we've just had our first kid last year.
Yep.
And so now we're in the for the first time in our lives, we're thinking about these things.
Yeah.
We haven't really actually thought about or talked about homeschooling, but we've definitely talked about trying to keep her out of daycare and avoid all of that because we both work for ourselves. So
yep.
How come you guys decided to go down that road?
Our main reason was probably anxiety issues with the kids. So both of them were struggling in the school setup. They weren't relaxing into school at all, and they were having problems. My boy was having problems even just focusing in class. He's got ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
He's now 16 and he's learned to control it really, really well. He's doing great homeschooling. Much, much Fantastic. Better. He's able to concentrate. He sits down and gets all his work done. It's not become a stressful situation where we're in daily talks with the school and all of that kind of stuff. Mm. And he's really flourishing doing that, you know? So
yeah,
it's good. It's worked out well. And it's the same for my youngest daughter. She's 12.
Mm-hmm.
She had the same anxiety issues.
Yep.
So, same thing. She's doing really, really well doing it at home. Plus I work from home. My wife's here most of the time. We're able to oversee all the schoolwork. I'm only gone in the afternoons when they're finished. So my work tends to start more around 2 or 3 o'clock. So while they're here, I do have a couple of students, by the way, come to the house in the mornings.
Oh, yep. Yep,
yeah. Cool. So I'm doing some students here from home while the kids are doing their work. And it just works for the way our family works. It works really well.
It's actually a cool dynamic that way, isn't it? That you can actually spend more time with your kids during the day rather than, obviously, some people just have to go to work 9 to 5 and, you know.
Absolutely. And I can understand why that'd be an impossible. It just would, if you had that situation, it wouldn't work. You've got to be there doing it with the kids and helping them and spending the time together.
But I've always wondered, like, how can you home, like, what does that require to be able to homeschool? I mean, do you have to sort of level up yourself and sort of become a teacher?
The very first time that I started, I felt like I did, and I sorted out the whole curriculum for the kids myself for the whole year. That was a massive undertaking, and I didn't realize what resources were really available. And I would never ever do that again. It took hours and hours and hours of work. I was up really late all the time just working out all the lessons myself. The following year, we came across a company called Yuka, where at least they send you all the curriculum and all and everything via their interface. So you get to just download all of the work for the kids. You print off each week.
Yep.
You give them the work. And there's a lot of online resources that the kids use as well.
Yeah.
And then we get to just oversee it, and it works really, really well. They've gotten used to it now. They just get handled their bundle of work for the week at the beginning of that week. And my boy loves to surf. He's really active. He loves fishing and all sorts of other stuff. And he's learned to kind of stay really active, which is great for his ADHD stuff.
Yep.
And still get all his work accomplished while he's still kind of getting all that energy burnt off. Yeah,
absolutely. So is it based around, you know, rigid hours? Like do you have to sort of stick to a 9 to 3 thing, or is it just about getting the work done?
Yeah, no rigid hours now at all anymore. So, I mean, as much as we can, we try and start them at 9 o'clock in the morning. But if if the surf's really good and my boy wants to go for an early wave, he just goes.
Yeah, yeah.
He'll go and come back and start his schoolwork at 11, you know. So
I love that. I love that because I mean, I know that there's a lot to be said about the discipline of routine, you know, and that side of things is important in many ways. But I mean, I really struggled in the past with that idea of it. School for me sort of felt like prison. I definitely didn't do well in the conventional curriculum. Years later, I found out I was dyslexic.
Okay.
And I was just never going to do well in that system.
My eldest daughter is dyslexic.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how did you sort of figure that out? Because no one figured it out for me.
Yeah, well, she went through most of school struggling,
right?
You know, but I think it was Bronte herself who worked it out.
Interesting.
You know, so she just realized every time she was going to read, She was being distracted by things that were happening on either side of the page, and that the words would get jumbled up.
Yep.
She was also in and out of focus a lot. So I think she worked it out herself.
Yeah.
Yeah. It took quite a while. I think it wasn't until she was about in sixth class or year seven.
Yeah. Well, it took me until I was about 35.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And I was just reading about it and I was like, wait a minute. And it was to me, it was actually sort of liberating in a way, because it made me realize that it hadn't been my fault, you know?
Yeah.
It also made me a bit angry. It made me angry that
it wasn't picked up.
And how could my life have been different, you know?
Yep.
But it was pretty interesting to learn that dyslexia isn't a handicap. You know, it's actually an advantage in many ways.
Yep, yep.
I mean, basically, when I was a kid and through to now, really, I just had this constant feeling that the system didn't work, like the system didn't make sense. Not in a weird kind of underground conspiracy way, but just kind of going like, I'd sit a test and I'd have to get the test done in 90 minutes. Yep. And I'd think, surely in real life, this isn't how it works, you know?
Yep.
Surely in real life, you've got a task and the goal is just get it done well. And if you have to do some research and call someone, you do. You don't have to get it all lumped into 90 minutes. So I had a problem with the whole thing.
Yeah. I think more and more, there's lots of parents who are doing things like homeschooling and taking kids out of that whole, the system.
Yeah.
Yeah. And finding that it works better.
Yeah, exactly.
Happier families, happier kids. You know?
I mean, think about the life that we're so used to, and the pandemic has turned it on its head in so many ways, you know, but the idea that we all get up and go off to work and sit in traffic every day, and just this routine that we're in that doesn't really get us anywhere.
No.
And then, I mean, I think in some ways, the kind of lives that you and I have would have been considered alternative in the past, but now we're kind of geniuses.
Well, we wish. But I reckon it's a wonderful thing, because that's what I was just going to say. It's kind of probably being a musician that's enabled me to be able to do that, to make that work. If I was doing my 9-to-5 grind job, well, I couldn't make this work with the kids. And I think it's for our benefit.
Absolutely. And it's not just a case of the practical setup of our jobs, but it's also the fact that we end up learning how to think like that, you know, and sort of think differently and solve problems, because being a musician is such a, I mean, we just don't know ever what to do next. So we're constantly trying to figure things out.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, you're living sort of gig to gig, record to record. And for when you're teaching, term by term, you know, and you're constantly looking for things all the time.
Yeah. And also trying to sort of navigate all the changes in the business and everything. So obviously the business has changed a lot in the last 20 years. So it's. I mean, I often get the compliment that I'm good at problem solving, and I kind of think, well, yeah, obviously.
Because you have to.
Exactly.
You have to. There's no choice. Yeah.
So how do you, you said you teach a lot of improv. It's a really interesting thing to teach. How do you approach it?
I have a jazz background, I guess, so although I've never been to the Con or anything like that, but I did study under a couple of jazz guitarists. I studied under a guy when I was a kid who'd written a lot of books. His name was Don Andrews, who used to work with George Goller. And I probably went to him for a couple of years, and then I studied under a guy named Carl Orr, who was a jazz fusion player who's sort of taken off to England to work with Billy Cobham. And I think he just did Sting's musical, The Last Ship. He was playing guitar in that.
Very
setup.
Cool.
He's worked with lots of great people. He worked with lots of, he was, you know, entrenched in the Sydney jazz scene. So my background, I guess, comes from working with them. So I have that little, you know, 3 o'clock to 5:30 period where I'm mainly teaching kids. Lots of songs.
Yep.
And then I have, as it's getting a bit later in the evening or in the mornings, I've got my more adult students who are working on the improv. And then I kind of just, because I've played in enough bands over the years and been around long enough, I had a look at your little bio there on your website. It looks like you've done and been around a lot, but I've played in lots of different styles of things, you know, from indie rock to funk to calypso and reggae to jazz and rock. So depending on which direction the student wants to go, I just kind of make a plan based on what they like and what they enjoy and what they want to get out of it. Yep. I'm not the kind of teacher who starts opening a book
right.
and going, we're going to begin page one and turn the pages. I try and tailor whatever I'm doing to them.
I'm the same. I look at it like a personal trainer, where you meet the person yeah. where they're at. You sort of assess their level of strength and fitness, and then you decide yep. what they need to do next, you know? But I do find yeah, it interesting man. How in the world of teaching improv and also songwriting, I find yep. it really interesting how, to some people, the idea of being creative is just, the door is firmly closed. Even if they really are interested in, you know, really want to do it. I yep. find it interesting because somehow, for reasons that escape me, it was always wide open for me. I was just like, yeah, I'll just yep. write a song. I'll just work this out.
I was the same.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I actually enjoy the challenge of trying to get the door open for people.
Yeah.
And it's really satisfying when you do open that door because it's like giving them a gift, you know?
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Absolutely. Actually, it was actually one of the things I did with the kids during the pandemic. Some of the little kids were finding it hard, the Zoom lessons.
Mm.
Attention to looking at a screen and realizing someone's talking to them and teaching them when they're, you know, under 10
mm.
or under 12 was kind of hard. And they'd get distracted easily and or get bored, or I could see them looking at their phones or their iPads, you know, below. A lot of that sort of stuff. So I did a thing with them where I just got, I think I picked about 10 students where I got them all to pick their favorite four chords
mm-hmm.
and their favorite rhythms. And let me know what they were. And I put together a little worksheet PDF, which I sent out to all of them, where they had to write some lyrics.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Come up with their favorite rhythm and their favorite chords in an order that they liked. And then I would work with them over Zoom to create a melody over those chords.
Mm-hmm.
And then I recorded all their songs on GarageBand.
Wow.
Just using some simple, you know, drum machine beats and things, and it was great fun, and the kids all loved it. But that thing you said about giving them a gift,
yeah,
man, the parents thought it was the most amazing thing.
Yeah,
they were sending the songs to grandparents and cousins, and you know, they thought it was incredible. It is like giving a gift.
It really is.
And then they want to try it again.
Exactly, and it's like setting people free in a way, because yeah. that's the funny, and I'm confident you'll agree with me that songwriting is only difficult if you think it's difficult. But as soon as you realize yeah. it's not difficult, you just kind of go, oh yeah, all I need to do is just put stuff together and see if I like it.
And just, that's it. Hey, but that's yeah. the hard. In the end, that's the hard part, because I have this thing, you know, I was listening to your interview with Damien Binder, and you guys were talking a little bit about writer's block, and you were saying how you don't get it.
Right.
And I do get it, but I was thinking about it while you guys were talking, and I think it's not that it's writer's block. It's just that I don't like anything that I'm putting down on paper. I'm writing lots of stuff. I just don't like it.
But you must like something every now and then, right?
Every now and then. And that's what yeah. happens. And I think it becomes part of your, maybe what I'm calling writer's block is actually part of the process.
Yeah.
Where it's like I'm writing lots of stuff, and maybe even sometimes for months.
Right.
That I just don't like it.
Yeah.
And I'm just throwing it away and throwing and going, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not liking the lyrics. I'm not liking the melodies. And then I'm finally... So you'll break through with something. And often when I'm starting a record, it's that first song that'll kind of open the dam up a little bit.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, I get all of that. I think I agree with what you just said, is I just see that as part of the process. I just don't see that as writer's block. I just, you know, I just believe in quantity. And I always remember that quote from Stevie Wonder, that he had that discipline of writing one song a day. And I just figure if you write a song every day, most of them will probably be terrible, but every now and then one of them will be superstition, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, I just, again, I think writer's block is almost just self-perpetuating in a way. I mean, if you don't have an idea, then you don't have an idea. And it's only a block if you're desperately trying. But I guess also where I'm sort of wandering here because I don't quite know where I'm going. But I think the other thing is, I don't know, I just think it's about throwing stuff against the wall and seeing if you like.
Well, I think sometimes I'm like, I know with my last record, I had an idea about what I wanted to write about. I was making a record about my mum, who had passed away a little while ago. And I had a concept. I knew what I wanted to write about. I had stories. I'd gathered a lot of family history, and I had mum's notes and letters and things. And I had a lot of material.
Mm.
But every single time I went to put the pen to the paper, whatever I wrote just kind of felt too sentimental or too mawkish, right, or too Hallmark card. And I just, I had to get through that process first of writing all of that stuff, getting it out of my system.
Yeah.
And then going, okay, now I want to write the best lyrics that I can.
Yeah.
And I think then there was one song and it just broke the, dam.
It
just meant that I knew where I was going. I had a direction, but I had to go through that horrible process first, which I call writer's block, but it's not really, I don't think it is. I think it's just, I've got to go through this first.
I've found over the years that I can't really write anything very well if I'm still in the middle of the emotion. I need to have it behind me a little bit. And I think I relate exactly to what you mean for different reasons. But yeah, it's almost like if you're pissed about something, you just write some sort of garbage angry song. That, but once you process it a little bit, and you're just a bit disconnected from it.
Yeah.
Then I guess you're writing the song more than the emotion, and it sort of, I don't know, it just balances it out a little differently.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that's really true. You've got to distance yourself to some degree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also relate to what you're saying about just getting the dam to open a little bit, and then it sort of all happens. I mean, I've found that with stuff I've done in the past where you go, oh, I don't know what this is going to be, and then you just, you sort of get an idea and you go, that's the angle. That's now sort of the theme of this next chapter. It's always exciting when that happens.
Yeah, it is. And it's not just music, is it? I think, like, I was doing some painting is the same thing. During the lockdowns, I thought, I'm just going to do some paintings.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. I did lots of paintings that I didn't like them. I just chucked them out. But then you start to go, okay, I'm finding the angle.
Right.
And then you go, okay, well, I'm able to do a little series now because I understand where I'm heading or what I'm doing with the paintbrush. Or that, for me, that was a new learning experience.
Yeah.
But I think that's how it is with the arts. You often just spend this horrible process of just finding your beginning.
Right, yeah. And
if
I also,
that makes sense.
I also have this sort of rule for myself that I don't let myself overwork an idea, because I just started to notice over the years that every time I was getting to that point where I was really working on it, it usually ended up being a terrible idea, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, all the good songs seem to just sort of fall out. So I started to think about that and go, well, why is that the case? Maybe it's because the good songs that fall out are just better formed ideas and they require less work to then finish.
Isn't it funny that, because that happens with me, if you write a song fast, if it comes to you really, really quick, I know the song that broke the dam with me.
Mm.
I had to get away from my computer in this desk when I was writing, and I went outside to the beach.
Right.
I just sat on the sand, and this whole song just came out in one go.
Exactly.
Lyrics, all fully formed, melody, just wrote it all down.
Exactly.
And when that happens, it's a really wonderful thing. I wish it happened more often. It doesn't happen anywhere near enough.
Right.
But then on the other hand, I read things about people like Paul Simon, who just takes a really long time to write a song, and just kind of sometimes months, you know, while he's just sort of going over and over lyrics and changing chord progressions and trying it in different keys. And I guess everyone's got a process, but I love it when a song comes out really quickly. It's an amazing thing. It's like a dream when that happens.
I would suspect that in Paul Simon's case, he's in a different way doing the same thing. Like, if he's trying the song in different styles and moods and tempos and things like that, he's sort of exploring it and looking for... I'm obviously completely guessing here, but I would imagine that he's not over-engineering it. He's just sort of moving it around and trying to work out where it's going to click.
Where it's best. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is like a different version, I think, of what we're describing. Because sometimes I'll get stuck on a song and I'll just put it aside. And then a year later I go, oh, I get it.
Yep.
You know, and then it will click. So it's sort of the same idea in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I also noticed on... did you watch the Peter Jackson Get Back series?
Yeah, I have. I haven't... I'm up to the concert. I haven't watched the concert yet, but I've watched everything leading up to it.
So what I was going to comment on was the, you know, how they're constantly messing around and they're playing their songs in a jokey way and kind of taking the piss and having a laugh a lot, right?
Yep.
So I think most people would have seen that and thought, yep, that's pretty funny and whatever. I actually saw it a little deeper and I thought, I think this is part of their genius, because they're kind of stretching and pulling and almost trying to break the songs. right? So yep. instead of being super paranoid about this is how the song goes, we must play the song this way.
Yeah.
They're kind of like, well, what happens if we speed it up and slow it down and make it country and make it jazz and like fuck with it as much as they can?
Yeah, yeah. Take the mickey out of each other while we're doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, and yeah. I think yep. it's actually a really, really beneficial process to go through because it kind of, it organically cuts out all the less important aspects of the song and it gets the structure of the song to really sit properly. So when they then go to play it properly, they really know it and they also know which bits are more important than the other bits.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's really true. Mm. And I think that's kind of true with their lyrics because that's why the, you know, sometimes you can get very, very serious about your lyrics and I definitely tend to do that.
Mm.
Whereas that thing about them being lighthearted about it, often just singing rubbish, you know, funny, hilarious, you know, goon show
yeah.
style lyrics over the top of their songs. A lot of it ends up in there in the end.
Yeah.
You know, and all those little funny catchphrases that, that John and Paul would throw backwards and forwards to each other, they end up in the songs.
Absolutely.
Because they stick and they just end up being great. They end up being the parts that I think everybody likes, probably because it's so natural because they did it so much.
And I also think that often those ideas can be more emotive anyway, because again, if
yeah.
if someone's singing something almost too directly and too earnestly, it becomes to feel a bit like, oh, you know. But I mean, I think about you know, one of my favorite albums of all time is Abbey Road, and on side B there's the lyric, "You never give me your money, you only give me your funny paper." And I find yeah, yeah. that lyric with the melody that goes with it just breaks my heart every time I hear it.
Yeah, yeah. It's perfect.
Yeah. And it's kind perfect. Of a, it's yeah. kind of a jokey line in a way, but it's actually
yeah.
quite a powerful line.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good thing about being in a band when you're writing songs, like, and versus being a singer-songwriter by yourself,
mm.
is being able to do that, especially in a room, just kind of bounce things off each other. I know during the pandemic, because, you know, we were spending a lot of times in our own heads and in our own homes, and
mm.
I was finding writing my record really hard. So I just started, for the first time, I started just sending out the lyrics to the band members and saying, and actually asking people's opinions.
Wow.
Especially because I was so close to the subject matter.
Mm.
And I felt like I just needed a little bit of outside assistance.
It's interesting.
Beyond my own head. Like, is this working? Is this too sentimental, or is, you know, I was worried about those kind of things. I was wow. thinking, is this going to be a hard listen?
Mm.
But yeah, eventually, I think, you know, through getting some feedback from the other guys in the band, who are by the way really long term friends of mine who I've known since I was about 5 years old.
Yeah,
awesome. So they totally knew this the history and everything, and it was probably great to actually get their feedback. It worked really well.
I find it quite funny how when you're working with a band, you're working with people who are approaching the songs from completely different angles and don't yeah. necessarily care about the same things you care about. I remember going into a rehearsal maybe 15 years ago or so, we're getting ready for an album, and I was really stuck on a lyric, and I was asking everybody what they thought, this one or that one, you know. And I asked our drummer a couple of times, and he sort of didn't answer me at first, and then I sort of pinned him, and I said, "Dude, like, what do you think?" And he just looked at me and he goes, "I don't care." And I thought, "You prick." But then I thought,
well, that about sums it up.
but then I thought, I kind of get it too, because his job isn't to worry about that. His job is, no. you know, the other, he's looking at the songs differently. And so it challenged me to go, well, I guess people hear music in different ways, and I've got to make sure that the rhythm section are interested in the rhythm section. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
You know, the lyrics are for the people who care about the lyrics. I don't know. It just sort of got me out of my head a little bit, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Whereas if he asked you, you know, about four different kinds of hi-hat patterns, and you'd just be like, "I don't know, just pick one."
Yeah, just do one that sounds good. Once again, our show is brought to you by Auckland Guitar Lessons. Auckland Guitar Lessons are ideal for both beginners and experienced players. The lessons are focused towards learning good technique while having fun and enjoying the experience. Lessons are one-on-one and individually adapted to the student's personal goals and musical preferences. There's a long list of songs to choose from, and the student is also welcome to suggest any songs they would like to learn. All the fundamentals of technique and theory are covered within the context of songs, which helps people progress faster and makes the experience more enjoyable. If you've always dreamed of playing the guitar, or if you've been playing the guitar for a while and you feel like you've plateaued, Auckland Guitar Lessons can help unlock your playing, renew your confidence and drive, and help you make significant progress. Visit www.aucklandguitarlessons.co.nz. So I read in the press pack, there's a comment there about the incredible story of the return of a lost 1940s Tex Morton guitar. And I'm curious to know what that story is. I'm hoping it's a real story.
It is a real story, yeah. My granddad had this Tex Morton signature model guitar that he was a Tex Morton fan. He used to yodel and sing lots of country songs. He had 10 kids, of which my mum was one of the 10.
Mm.
And I guess a lot of nighttime entertainment was just to sit around, you know. They lived out at Nambucca Heads on you know, in the country. And they, I'd say a lot of nighttime entertainment was for him just to sit around with the 10 kids and sing and play guitar.
Yeah.
When my granddad was sort of, before he passed away, he had said to my mum that he wanted me to have the guitar.
Mm.
Which, you know, I always looked forward to, because it was a great piece of family history, that guitar.
Yeah.
When he passed away, he'd remarried about a couple of years beforehand, and the guitar just disappeared. We didn't know what had happened to it. And the story that came back was that the lady that he'd married, my mum's stepmum, had burnt it in a vengeful fire, so that the rest of the family couldn't have, and that there was a fire, that was true. There was a lot of family heirlooms that kind of got burnt.
Right.
And lots of paperwork and memories and photos, and I think a lot of stuff disappeared.
Yeah.
We were told the guitar went with it. Mum and I both have had our doubts that the guitar had been in the fire.
Why did you doubt that? If she had already burnt other heirlooms, why doubt the guitar?
Yeah, there was just some family history that made us think that maybe it was with another family member.
Okay.
Yeah. So we asked around Mum's brothers and sisters, and we couldn't track it down.
Right.
We figured it was gone. And, you know, years pass and you think maybe it has been lost. This would have all been happening when we were searching for it in the 90s, late 90s, I guess.
Yeah.
No, early 90s. Early 90s. Anyway, I tried to find one on Gumtree and eBay. I came across a couple, but never managed to actually snag one. Anyway, years later, fast forward all the way to 2019, and my mum gets cancer.
Right.
And a very short battle, about 6 weeks later, passes away.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was from diagnosis, it was pretty fast.
Yeah, wow.
So I start writing this record about mum, you know, and I start trying to gather all, you know, all the information. I'm doing lots of searching and going through mum's family history and her letters. Mum had actually written out all these little bullet point memories, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, of her childhood, which I did use for a lot of the record. That was an incredible find.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wonder, do you think she was planning to write some memoirs or something?
No, I think she just decided one day that she wanted to get a bunch of memories of him, so before they ever went or disappeared. I think she must have just wanted to get them down on paper. So yeah. There was all these, it was 3 pages of just like bullet point fragments of memory, you know, like, and they were great little things, like remembering the first time that the streetlights were installed and turned on in her street in 1957. Just stuff like that. The name of the takeaway shop that they used to go to, and waiting for the potatoes to be peeled while they made the chips. You know, just stuff like that. You know, yeah. It was full of really, really cool little kind of fragments of memory. Mm. And I used it for sort of the basis of starting some of the songs. Back to the guitar. When Mum passed away about 2 years later, I got a photo sent to me by my sister that had been sent to her by one of our cousins. And she said, oh, my cousin's just found this guitar in the basement. And she sent me the picture of the guitar. I knew straight away that it was the guitar. It was it's a very obvious guitar. It's a little yellow thing with a cowboy on a horse with a lasso painted on it.
Yeah.
Tex Morton's name across the, you know, I couldn't believe, my eyes just popped out of my head when I saw it.
Right, yeah.
And the cousin lived a bit of a drive away. I think she was in Orange. And my my sister had a friend who just happened to be driving through and stopped at my cousin's house, picked it up. My cousin said she'd be happy for me to have it. She'd found it in her garage. I don't even know if she ever knew it was there.
Wow.
And it got brought all the way back. And I ended up being able to use that very guitar that my grandfather used to use to play songs to my mum to finish writing some of the songs. And it ended up on the record as well, on about 5 tracks.
That's amazing. So, and once you found it, did you work out sort of what had happened to it along the way?
I think so. Right. Yeah, I think there was maybe an uncle who took it originally,
right?
And just kept it quiet. He played a little bit of guitar, and then a second uncle got it, and he didn't play guitar at all. He just left it in a case sitting somewhere, and it had disintegrated a little bit. So I had to take it to someone. The timber under the bridge had become a little bit rotten,
right?
So he had to do a little bit of work on it, but man, it's come up great, and it's just got a lot of character, and it's, man, just to be able to hold it. I can see where my granddad's thumb sat on the top of the bridge, and he's rubbed off all the paint.
Right.
You know, if I play a C or a G, you know, cowboy chord, my hands are going in exactly the same place. It's just it's the weirdest thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. That sounds like a really, really big problem if the wood underneath the bridge was rotting. How do you fix that without replacing the entire front of it?
Yeah, I don't know what he did, to be honest, because I didn't see under there, but somehow he's done it without replacing the whole top.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was starting, the bridge had lifted as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had to replace the bridge altogether.
Mm.
I don't know what he's done underneath. Yeah. I'd be interested to know. I just kind of went and picked it up and played it and was like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
He told me later what the work that he'd had to do. So, it's all come up good. It plays great.
I love how older instruments, they almost feel like you're time traveling in a way. The guitar that I learned on, that I very first started on, actually looks like that nylon string right behind you. And it was my mum
over here.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, it was my mum's guitar. And she apparently played it when she was a teenager and learned to play just, you know, I think folk songs out of a folk book or something. And for some reason, she stopped. I asked her at one point, why did you stop playing? Because this had absolutely nothing to do with me ending up playing. Like, it was just she played years before, and then years later, I ended up playing. And she said that her songbook was stolen on the train one day, and that was the end. And she was just like, well... She just then stopped playing. And I was like, well, why didn't you just buy another songbook? And I was like, and then part of me is going, well, that's not very committed, you know? But she had done the same thing where I can see, I've still got it. I can see on the fretboard what she played. I can tell what chord she knew. Because her nails, you know, gouged little.
As any girl's guitar looks like, you can see the fingernail gouge spots.
Yeah.
Yep, there's a C.
That's right. Yep. It's actually kind of amazing. And I've got a, up here on the wall over here, I've got a, it's a mandolin with a lute shaped body on it.
Yep.
And we don't exactly know the history, but we know that it's from Europe, sort of World War II, probably around the 40s.
Yep.
And you're just like, it's also, what's that? That guitar shop in LA, is it Norm's Guitars, I think it's called?
Norm's Rare Guitars.
Yeah, it's such a, have you been there?
No.
It's so amazing. And you're just like standing there looking at an acoustic, like looking at a Martin that's from like the 30s or something. And you're just thinking, this thing has been a guitar through like World War II, through Vietnam. Like, you just start to think about all the things that have happened in the world.
Yeah.
And the whole time, this thing's been a guitar. Like, that sort of thing just keeps me going for hours.
Oh, man, I've got a little 110-year-old guitar in the cupboard over here.
Wow,
which
110?
Is, apparently.
Yeah.
Apparently it was the company that became Washburn. I think it used to be called Lyon & Healy.
What?
And it's an old Lyon & Healy, and it's just a really small bodied little thing.
Yeah.
It's great. It's incredible guitar. It's got one of those V-necks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I quite like V-necks.
Yeah, they're actually quite comfortable.
Yeah.
It's got a really bell-like tone. It's a really beautiful guitar. And there's some guys in Brisbane called the Guitar Repairers who tend to find these kind of things and restore them and then send them out. And I just saw it and fell in love with it. And it's a beautiful little guitar. It's, and like you said, there's just incredible history.
Yeah, I had no idea that Washburn or a version of Washburn went back that far.
Yeah, apparently that's the case. It was Lyon and Healy before it became Washburn.
I've been discovering recently that my history on guitars has been all over the place. Like, I saw a photo not too long ago of, I think it was George Harrison in the relatively early days of the Beatles playing an SG. And it just blew my mind, because for some reason, and I had decided that SGs came out in the late, sort of late 60s-ish period. And I was like, yep. how the fuck is George Harrison playing an SG in like 1964? And then I looked it up. And they came out.
Lo and behold.
Yeah, I actually now forget when they came out, but they came out before then anyway.
my guitar history used to be all right. I worked in a music shop for a while, but now I'm, you know, I don't. When you don't talk about it as much anymore, all the that was quite a few years ago. It goes, yeah. So I don't remember.
Well, it's the same as like Maton, which is obviously an amazing Australian brand, and I only discovered Maton about 20 something years ago when I started touring with Tommy Emmanuel. And when I heard him play it, I was like, that's the sound I've been trying to get out of other acoustics. And you know, so then I went and bought a Maton. And
yeah, that's one behind me there on this side.
Oh, nice. Yes, it is too. I could recognize the headstock. And I thought that I just discovered a new brand. And then I looked it up, and I think they go back to at least the 50s, don't they?
Yeah, the 50s, I think. Yeah. I've had that guitar for about 25 years.
Right.
It's a beautiful little guitar.
Yeah.
That was based on a Neil Finn model, I think.
Oh, okay.
EBG 808 artist model. I think it even got called the Neil Finn model at the time.
Well, I didn't realize Neil Finn played Maton.
Yeah.
I mean, they're amazing guitars. I can see why he would.
Yeah. It's a beautiful guitar. I've had it for a long time, and it's really come into its own.
Yeah. So on the we should talk about the new record, because I really, really like it. And what I'm now curious to kind of unpack, because we were talking before about, you know, writer's block and the process of songwriting and you having a background in jazz and things like that. And as you were saying all of that, I was thinking about the album, and I was thinking, like, it doesn't sound like you have writer's block. and it sounds like a really inspired album. It's a really, really, not only is it a good album in terms of, you know, melodies and structure and that kind of stuff, but it's also just an artistic, creative experience, you know, like you think you've got it figured out, and then the next song starts and you go, oh, that's different again, you know. And I'm used to jazz musicians, you know, they can sometimes, you know, climb up their own ass and be very regimented. And I love when I find musicians who learn the theory and kind of know all the moves, but then they can still open up the creativity and just not worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, I try really hard to strip all that away when I'm writing songs. In terms of all my guitar playing history, I don't, in the stuff that I write or the stuff that I do with that band or the stuff that I record, I want to strip it. And it's coming down, I guess, to that core thing that what works best for the song.
Yeah.
That genre hopping thing, I love it, but it's probably at the same time a thorn in my side, because a lot of people find it hard to maybe follow my jumps.
Right.
But I, you know, I guess the music that I listen to tends to do that as well. And I don't know whether it's that I get bored or I just want to follow the song and in the end hope that my voice and the band is the thing that pulls it all together and then makes it when you listen to the record across as a whole, that it feels like a complete piece of art in the end. I hope, you know, and that's the danger. I don't know why it is that I jump around so much. I even think sometimes at the beginning of a record, okay, I'm really going to make this kind of record. It just doesn't happen.
Well, I mean, here's my take on it, because I've actually had the same problem in my career, and I've had people tell me that as well. Like, you know, you're all over the map. You know, we can't figure out exactly what you are. And early on, I was more paranoid about it. And these days, I think, good, I'm glad I'm like that. Because I think what happened was, you know, artists used to just write like that and try different stuff. I mean, Christ, look at the Beatles catalog. You know, they recorded all of that in 7 years, you know, and it's all over the place. They set the example, but now as music has become far more strategic
yep.
and corporatized and stuff. This is your brand. You've got to stay on brand. Yeah. You know, all of that. Fuck that. That's anti-art, you know? And
I like you. Because, mate, I'm exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And I can't even listen to an album from beginning to end when nothing changes and it just feels like I'm listening to the same song 12 times over.
Right.
Or some derivative of it. I get bored.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I want to be challenged a bit musically. I want to just, and that's why I guess I like the people who I listen to. The Beatles is the best example because, man, listen to the White Album and try and pin that down.
It's the
most incredible piece of art.
Mm.
But yeah, it's all over the place.
Absolutely.
And it's brilliant. And there's lots of artists I like who've done that over the years. I mean, Tom Waits is another one who he does that all the time on records. Wilco, who I love a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, you know, they started off as an old country kind of thing, but they've just kind of gone into so many different directions and even on the space of one record.
Right.
I love that stuff.
And you were saying a second ago, you know, I don't know why I'm like that. Maybe I get bored. And I'm just thinking, well, you're like that because you're an artist, you know, because to me, staying on brand, as they say, is like having the same thing for dinner every night, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, why would you want to do that? You know?
It's a corporate mentality though, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is.
I'm making a record because I need to fulfill these things to get on Spotify playlists or whatever it is, or to reach my target audience or to, you know, get the algorithms. Whatever it is that makes music work these days, it bores me to tears.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because in my opinion, a large part of this whole process is about taking chances. And a lot of my favorite artists have released songs that I don't really like, or there are albums that I don't really like, but I'm kind of on board with it because I'm like, I love the fact that they had a go, they took a risk,
they stretched, yeah,
they stretched, yeah, exactly,
yeah.
But you can't do that if you're having to stay on brand.
No,
you just become. No, a ginger
imagine
nut.
If someone was telling the Beatles that, all the great music that wouldn't have been created, you know,
yeah.
It's just. But no one was telling them that then, you can't do this or you can't do that. They were finding ways of experimenting and making those things work instead, you know? And it's, it makes a massive difference. Yeah. And I've been like that. I've always been like that. It's not just with when I make a record, it's what I buy.
Right.
It's what I listen to. And I guess, you know, I get frustrated sometimes when, you know, critics or people that are like, I don't really get it. Where are you? Or what genre do you call your music? I don't even know how to answer that.
Mm, yeah.
You know, I usually just end up saying, well, it's an Americana folk thing meets indie something. And, you know, you end up sort of giving them four or five or six different genres.
Well, this is where I think the whole thing's broken because we're supposed to be stepping outside the genre. I see genre as being a retrospective idea. You know, you look back decades later and you go, well, what was that? And you go, I guess it was New Wave. And you go, oh, okay.
Yep.
But the reason why New Wave happened is because someone went, I don't want to sound like Led Zeppelin. I want to do the next thing.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And my complaint is that we have too much influence coming from non-artists that impact our jobs. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but in New Zealand, we're just suffocated by our funding system.
Yeah.
If you don't get in the funding system, you don't get on the radio, you don't get on the festival. So you've got to now play to the funding system. And the these are people who, they're not in the trenches as musicians. They don't know what to do, you know. They're just trying to figure out what's going to work for radio because it worked last year, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Hey, my dog just started crying at the door. One second.
Yeah, no problem.
I would say my wife just got home and she wants to go and see my wife. So had enough of me.
One thing I do love about your new record is all of the surprising notes here and there, you know, where there's like, you obviously love to put some tension in the music and note choices, a bit of dissonance and that sort of stuff. And my approach to sort of creativity versus theory is that I try to, you know, take on board as much information as I can, as many influences, and learn about theory constantly and all of that kind of stuff. And like sort of put into my musical library as much as I can. And then when I'm in the creative mode, sort of turn it all off and just let it influence.
Let it happen.
From the background. Yeah, yeah. So when I'm listening to your record and I'm hearing like, oh, that's an interesting note, you know, that's a surprising chord. Are you sort of doing that mathematically a little bit, or are you just sort of going with the flow at that point?
Probably going with the flow at that point. Yeah, because I'm the same. I think sometimes the theory, when you've had to teach music, the theory messes with your sense of creation sometimes. And, you know, once again, I don't want to be sort of creating music that's formulaic or sits in some kind of box, or I'm going, okay, hang on. So the song, I'm in the key of C. These are the chords I'm supposed to use. I kind of want to throw all that away and go, okay, how can I break that up? How can I mess that up?
Right.
How, and I guess maybe that's part, you know, when you listen to a lot of songs on the radio these days that become popular, there's none of that. There's often now, especially more than ever, four chords. And the four chords keep going for the chorus and for the bridge.
That's right.
You know, and nothing changes. And it's become so boring to listen to, you know. So I'm looking for ways when I write to kind of break it up. So I might come up with a song and maybe it is four chords, but I'll look for a point somewhere where I can mess with it.
Put a surprise in there.
Yeah.
I often think about like the modern songwriter writes with the laptop, and so when they want to create dynamics, you know, or something like that, they do it with, you know, they change the synth sound, or they get a fatter kick sound or something. They sort of do it with production techniques rather than musically.
Yep.
But if you imagine like the traditional songwriter who sits at the piano and says, well, I want my chorus to feel bigger, and the only way to do that is to find a chord that makes it feel bigger.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. So
it's in the composition.
And because we record mostly live, that like my last three records were recorded mostly live. So this time there was a little bit of overdubbing because we had to lockdowns and COVID things and things. So we ended up doing recording at home and sending them in.
Yep.
And we didn't get to go live into a room like we did on the last two. But when you're playing live, that's the other thing as well. You can't really make those production decisions like that you would when the whole band is sitting around a computer and recording track by track.
Yep.
So you've just captured what you've captured, which was for us the band in the room.
Exactly.
So we're rehearsing that material a lot before we go in and making the decisions about where all those things are going to happen to bring life into a chorus or
and you learn so many great lessons in that way. You know, like there's three or four of you or whatever in a room and the chorus isn't really popping. How do we make the chorus bigger? Can't think of an idea. Actually, I know how to do it. Let's take stuff out of the verse. So we differentiate, and you're organically writing dynamics rather than relying on, we got to put a drop. Here comes the drop.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, because that stuff drives me nuts. You know, it's like, or like going, okay, where are we, you know, this little section isn't working, so what bits are we going to cut out?
Yeah.
That to me should have happened ages ago. That should have happened before you got there, you know. And I think that's the really good thing about creating all that dynamic in a room. Sometimes even getting out of a chorus and into a bridge, or out of a bridge and back into a chorus, something that you wrote at home seemed to work really well.
Yep.
But when you do it with the band, it just feels wrong or weird, and then you've got to work through that. Whereas if you'd done the whole thing on a computer, you would have just put down your guitar demo and the rest of the band would have played over the top. And then you listen later and go, we need to do some cuts and edits and things to make this feel right.
That's right. Yep.
You know, so I would weigh, and my other thing is I'm a great second guesser all the time. You know, I'm just constantly second guessing myself. So to be in a room with four guys who are, there's that immediate sounding board, whether or not something's working, I'd rather do that any day.
Absolutely, yeah. And then you get those surprises as well, which is one of the things I love about working with other musicians is, you know, I've played drums in the past and I've played bass in the past. Like, I know how to play the instruments and I could actually make a whole album just by myself.
Yep.
But it would be a very one-dimensional album, you know. And our drummer, Jasper, comes from quite a different background in music. So when he approaches something, he just lands it differently to what I would ever come up with if I was sitting at the
table.
You know, and usually what they come up with just is so much better than what I would have thought of, you know, and that type of thing. I'm trying to think of what the example was, but there was a problem that we were trying to solve coming from one section to another section when we were in the studio recently. And I think the comment was it actually felt like an edit, even when we were playing it live.
Yeah, yeah, it was okay.
Like, this bit and then that bit, and it was just like no sort of organic way of getting from this idea to that idea.
Yep.
And I think it was Jasper that solved it by going, well, I'll change the beat up here, and then I'll sort of set it up a few bars earlier and then bring us into it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why you need an expert drummer and not someone just poking around on a MIDI keyboard.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I know it's the same in my band. I mean, I can play bass as well, but the bass player just comes up with such... He comes up with really interesting lines.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I tend to play things maybe in a formulaic kind of way. He doesn't have all the theory knowledge, but he just comes up with these incredible melodic lines that plays right over the top of everything.
Yeah.
And Jamie Hutchings, who's, you know, he was in a band called Blue Bottle Kiss that were quite well known a few years back, and he's developed his own guitar sound. And
right,
you know, there's something that you really know as soon as he starts playing, you can tell it's him.
Mm.
And I love that. It brings in all these things into my, even though I'm calling it, it's my name and it's a singer-songwriter type thing.
Mm.
I think if you listen to my last three records, there's a really strong band sound, which you can kind of hear come across, you know.
Yeah.
It's because we've just played live in a room. And those guys bring, I don't write parts out for them. I just let them do their thing, you know, and it's created something, I think, or I hope, that sounds like us.
Do you give them any kind of sort of vague conceptual direction?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. Mm. I'll send them all out a rough demo and yep. some chord charts, but then I just kind of let them go.
Yeah.
You know, and usually it's always better than what I did by myself.
Right, yeah.
It's not very often I have to go, oh, well, you know, we need to change that or strip this back or take that idea out. Or I usually just love what they do.
Yeah.
And once again, I think it's because we've known each other for such a long time.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where do you find, I mean, I've been asking lots of people this, I think I asked Damien this as well, but where do you find the spark and the motivation these days, you know, when it is so hard to make money in music, and you know, when it's so hard to sort of reach an audience in such a saturated and fragmented culture? I mean, are you a pure artist that you just got to get it out, or there, do you have other goals for the record, or how does it work in your head?
I do it completely and utterly for the love.
Yeah.
There's no other reason. It doesn't make me any money. It yeah. usually breaks even. If I'm lucky, I break even, and I've got enough by breaking even to go and do the next one.
Mm.
I kind of do it just because I love it. I certainly don't have any massive kind of following. I'm just playing to a small little community of people who seem to enjoy what I do.
Yep.
That's nice. And I really appreciate that. I've crowdfunded my last two records
mm-hmm.
and managed to make enough money to cover vinyl, CD and publicity.
Wow. That's,
you know, awesome. Which has been really good. So there is a little community who've and that's a nice feeling, even yep. though it's really small.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's absolutely just because I love it. I love making music. I love writing songs. And then when you're finished, if they're just sitting here on my desk or on my computer, and I haven't got them out there, it feels kind of pointless. It's almost just like I'm driven because I want to and I love it.
Right.
In terms of making any money or having grand plans or huge goals of, you know, Australia-wide domination, I let all that go a long time ago. I'm just really happy doing what I'm doing, and I just enjoy it.
We had a guy on the podcast, I think episode 5 or something. Like this was probably going to be about it.
You got a good memory.
Yeah. No, I've totally got that wrong. I just sounded confident when I said it.
Because I just looked how many you've done, and you've done a lot.
yeah. No, it's all muddled together. And also, I'm now desperately trying to remember the guy's name. He's a saxophone player, and he played with like Supertramp and Pink Floyd and a few bands like that. Really good dude. But he teaches business and music these days, and he teaches the idea that focusing on having a small list of loyal followers who are actually going to turn up to shows and buy albums and things like that, as opposed to trying to be, you know, have an audience of millions and millions of people who, you know, are sort of indifferent. He goes, it's not really a business plan. Like, trying to get millions of fans is not really a business plan. But having building a small community is actually how you start anyway, whatever your goals are. And my view on seeing this whole thing, and I'm curious to know if you sort of look at it this way as well, is maybe I don't make all the money back on recording projects all the time on of my own sort of, you know, original music, but I have a career which includes being a session musician and a guitar tutor and a producer and a podcaster and all these things, and they all kind of play into each other.
Yep.
You know, so if I stop functioning as a musician, I sort of lose my legitimacy in other areas.
yeah, which, absolutely.
But I think that's that actually, you know, sort of joking aside, I think it's actually true anyway, because I think it's, I mean, I know the people that I teach value the fact that they're learning from somebody who does actually have experience.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, is that how you see it too, sort of as a writer?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, I'm doing the same thing where I'm juggling all those things. And if you remove one of them, I don't know, it would feel like a massive part of who I am is taken away.
Yeah.
Especially if I take out that part of me that still makes records and makes music.
That's right. Yeah.
If I just became the guitar teacher and the guy, the session guy and whatever, I don't know. I don't know that I'd feel that I was properly creatively fulfilled.
Right. Yeah.
So there is that spark that wants me to do it. And that thing about having that core community or that little group, I'm indebted to those people. I'm grateful.
Yeah.
You know, that they've all helped me make a record, and I almost will go the extra mile when I'm packaging things up for them and sending them out, throwing in little bonuses and things like that, because I'm grateful. And they're allowing me to keep doing something that is really important to me.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and I think if you can build on that, it works.
Yeah. And if you ever do second guess yourself in terms of why am I putting the energy into this, or why am I spending the money on this or whatever, let's not forget that there are people who play golf. And, you know, they have a habit of spending way too much money and wasting way too much time doing something that's basically pointless. So.
Yeah, no, that's so true.
I really encourage people to check out your latest album, which is called Nam. How do you say it? Nambuka?
Nambuka.
Nambuka Fables.
Actually, I got a friend who's a Kiwi, but he says it the same way, Nambuka. So maybe that's how you guys say it there.
Well, there's Sambuka. The
that's
drink.
Right. There is.
I think that says a lot about us.
Mate, see, there's a rhyme in there that I didn't use on the whole record that could have.
What a waste. Yeah. Wasted opportunity.
Never even thought of that.
You know, it's been super fun talking to you. It's actually flown by, and really, really great to meet you, and all the best for the album.
Thank you so much, Danny. Really, really appreciated it, mate.
If you find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share, and subscribe, and give us a review on iTunes.